Guantanamo, A Father and Son's Story. Pardis Cabrai, our guest, a staff attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights. She represented Abdel Nasser Kantumani and his son Mohammed since 2008. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkner, Nafel Saramatra, Nermin Sheikh, Stu Martinez, Samaka, Pani Masood, Ravi Karandina, Gesdar, Amy Littlefield. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 7:59. Coming up next is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio with our host, Paul Rowland.
This coming weekend marks the one-year anniversary of a catastrophic mudslide in Oslo, Washington that killed 43 people. A year later, many questions about the mudslide and what led up to it has still not been answered. This Friday, March 20th, KBOO Radio will have a special program from 8 a.m. to noon to look into the human activities that led up to the slide and the lessons that can be learned from the disaster. That's Friday, March 20th, 8 a.m. to noon on KBOO 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Last Days in Vietnam, a film screening on Thursday, March 19th at Concordia University in Portland. Last Days in Vietnam is a new documentary from Rory Kennedy which examines the final days of American presence in Saigon and the efforts taken to evacuate 135,000 South Vietnamese. Again, that's Last Days in Vietnam, Thursday, March 19th at 6 p.m. at the Hagen Building at Concordia University, 2811 Northeast Holman Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Tune in to Prison Pipeline on March 23rd at 6:30 p.m. to hear part two of Maya Shenhwar speaking about her book, Locked Down, Locked Out, Why Prison Doesn't Work, and How We Can Do Better. Professor Rachel Cunliffe will also be giving commentary during part two.
Building a different world beyond prison is not just about knocking prison down, it's about raising up not only alternatives to dealing with conflict, but a world where people are cared for. If people are cared for, you're going to see a lot less harm. You're going to see a lot less violence, and you're going to see fewer survival times, too.
Again, that's March 23rd at 6:30 p.m. for part two of this conversation with Maya Shenhwar.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing and Full Circle Resale, featuring women's clothing, jewelry, and accessories with a focus on natural fibers since 1984. Gazelle and Full Circle Resale are both located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont and at Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing.
And good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. That YouTube song seemed to have ended abruptly there. That was Bob Paltrow with the Oil Train song. Apparently, an engineer says we had a network stall. That's the risk you do when you play directly off of YouTube. Anyway, my name is Paul Rowland, and this is Wednesday Talk Radio, and we are going to talk about bomb trains, oil trains exploding, it seems like, every week. I have our guest, Matt Landon, with Vancouver Action Network. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning.
And we're going to start out talking about more explosives. I met Matt back east in West Virginia and Kentucky. He was active. He was actually active in Tennessee, fighting against mountaintop removal with the Tennessee Mountain Defenders. Is that the name of the group?
Yeah, United Mountain Defense.
United Mountain Defense
and Mountain Justice as
and
well.
Mountain Justice. That's where we got to know each other. I was there for just a few months in southern West Virginia. And just a very difficult experience watching those beautiful old mountains being blasted away. So, yeah, I wanted to start out talking about that issue, which people out here on the West Coast are pretty distant from, and hasn't been a whole lot in the news recently, unless you're really following it closely. So, we met each other, it was, 5 years ago now. 5 years ago, time flies. You've been out here for a year now?
Going on 2 years.
Going on 2 years. Anyway, so you're from back that part of the country, and what have you been hearing recently about what's going on in that issue back there?
Well, mountaintop removal is definitely a very destructive process, along with all types of surface mining for coal. And we're definitely, with the economic downturn, this has actually hit the communities of Appalachia that much harder, as coal companies are laying off people left and right, and just putting the amount of production has been going down to a certain extent with the dry up of the credit and stuff. So I mean, basically, what we're seeing is a lot of mines that are just being left there and not necessarily in the reclamation, and continuing to being polluting the water, and it's not necessarily any better when a whole bunch of folks in the community are out of work and in that sort of situation. So I mean, it's Southern Appalachia is always the front lines, and it is continuing to get pounded, even if the coal companies aren't blowing up as many mountains today as they were 5 years ago.
And of course, it's a with this whole global economy, you've got the price of coal, because of the coal coming out of the Powder River Basin, affects the mining of coal there. It's a extremely complicated thing. I don't know how to calculate the calculus of destruction here, but obviously the move towards natural gas is obviously what the so-called natural gas through fracking has dramatically impacted coal production, as more power plants go towards running off of gas. It's of course a huge issue, and of course they're doing a lot of that down in that area too. Anyway, let me have another sip of tea as I try to wake up a little bit here.
So we're seeing, as the U.S. is getting tighter regulations on coal burning power plants and such, and like I said, switching over to natural gas, is that the coal is still being mined. And instead of being burned here, it's being shipped to be burned in Asia and, overseas. So that's why, ending mountaintop removal and the actual extraction of the coal is, going to be one of the only ways to save the communities there and keep all that carbon and heavy metals from being emitted for us to breathe downwind.
So let's get to an issue closer at home here, something that you've been working on since you've been out here. Obviously, there's things to fight against wherever you go in this world, and the Pacific Northwest has become a major choke point, major focal point for the global fossil fuel economy, as I've talked about repeatedly on my show regarding shipping of lift of gas to produce, to make liquefied natural gas to ship overseas, the proposed propane terminal in North Portland, obviously coal trains coming from the Powder River Basin, talked a lot about that, and we've talked about the oil trains, and so that's what we're going to be focused on today. And you had been living for since you got here to in Vancouver, and you recently moved to this side of the river, but you're still active with the Vancouver Action Network, which has been monitoring the oil train situation over there. So talk about these oil trains that are coming down the Columbia River. You know, we just heard about, I forget where the one that just happened last week, another oil train exploded. There's been, I think, three or four major oil train explosions just this year.
Yeah, definitely. And we've seen at least 10 oil train explosions over the last 2 years. And so basically what we're looking at is the railroads are working with the oil companies, and they are shipping hydraulically fractured shale gas oil mix in DOT 111 rail cars, which are the black rail cars that have a red diamond-shaped placard on the side that says 1267. And the reason that traditionally crude oil has not been explosive, but the reason that these are exploding now is because of the natural gas, the gas that is mixed in with that oil.
And I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, so
that's why they're so explosive.
Yeah, it's the propane, it's the butane, it's the methane. These are, and these DOT 111 rail cars are only rated to be, you know, to hold their integrity at 7 miles an hour. At 7 miles an hour, if that rail car gets punctured or crashes, you know, a spark is all that it takes, one spark to be able to ignite these butane and propane, and it explodes. So, I mean, basically, you know, they shouldn't be putting the natural gas into the DOT 111 rail cars because they're only classified to be able to handle liquid hazardous waste or liquid hazardous materials. And so obviously propane and butane are not liquid.
So that's something that I haven't really heard much about. So that obviously they're, you know, they don't process it on site. They obviously they're shipping it elsewhere to be processed, which is why they all these other these gases are mixed in with the oil and make it so flammable. So wow, that's a pretty disturbing to think that there's these cars passing right by our houses that are full of oil plus something plus a basically an igniter. So that's why they explode. Yeah, because that's one of the most explosive. That hadn't really come out until they started, really until that explosion. What was it in Quebec? That was like 2 years ago, right?
Yes.
Vast, that killed a bunch of people, destroyed almost an entire town. And you know, these things, as people see, are happening on a regular basis, and it's just been in the past couple of years that these trains have really been coming through the rail lines in the Pacific Northwest since the oil production in the Bakken oil region of North Dakota has really ramped up and created tremendous issues over in that part of the country as well. So, you know, so here we do have the opportunity because there is a fair amount of tradition of activism here in the Pacific Northwest in Portland. And there has been a certain amount of success already in stopping a number of fossil fuel projects. It seems like they keep throwing them at us one after the other. There's been a success in stopping some of the coal terminals, success so far in stopping the liquefied natural gas plant in Warrenton. There's a lot of opposition against the proposed Pembina propane terminal in North Portland, et cetera, et cetera. So this is yet another thing to confront in our communities. So talk about the kind of organizing that you've done in particular since you got here and that you've seen had already been started in on the Washington side of the river regarding these oil trains.
So I was very fortunate to have moved here in a time when a lot of community organizing was happening, and you know, people Don Steinke with the Sierra Club, and a number of folks on the Vancouver side of the river were totally, you know, getting out there and talking to the neighborhood associations and working with the city council to actually pass, you know, getting a number of the neighborhood associations there on Washington side to actively oppose the building of the Tesoro Savage oil terminal, oil port there in Vancouver, which would actually be the largest export terminal or largest oil terminal of its kind in the country, shipping out 360,000 barrels a day, which is roughly about 4 or 5 1-mile long oil trains just coming into Vancouver. So the folks with the neighborhood associations were able to, you know, encourage the Vancouver City Council to pass the strongest resolution saying that they did not want this proposed Tesoro Savage terminal, as well as, you know, the New Star terminal that is in the process of, you know, sort of sneaking through like a slithery little snake and getting their permits and stuff. And then we also had, you know, so that's sort of one of the steps that was happening. You know, there hasn't, we, like, I guess folks in Vancouver have sort of been trying to figure out what our next steps are, you know, continuing to find additional cities to get stronger resolutions passed. But ultimately, the question on the Tesoro Savage permit comes down to the governor. And so, you know, we definitely need to be putting pressure, more pressure on the governor of Washington to, you know, make the decision that's going to be best for all the people in Vancouver.
So let me give out the number in case there's anybody from that area, Vancouver and Southwest Washington, or out in the gorge where these oil trains are passing by, who want to call in and weigh in on this issue. It's 503-231-8187 is the number to call in and join this conversation. My name's Paul, and I'm speaking with Matt Landon with the Vancouver Action Network, who's been working on this oil train issue. And he's involved in it's called a listening project, which we'll be getting into later on in the program, and talking to people who live along the rail lines and, you know, getting them to talk about their concerns, and also a oil train monitoring project, which has been meeting with some success. It's trying to extend that everywhere that these oil trains are going, have people actually call in and when they're passing through, and describing them and taking down information about them. So, if that's something that you would like to talk about yourself, please give us a call at 503-231-8187. We were hoping to have a rail worker come on the air with us this morning as well. Wasn't able. They could still call in. I was been in touch with a couple people, and they're involved in a couple of major gatherings called the Future of Railroads, Safety, Workers, Community, and the Environment. And they had the first one down in Richmond, California on Saturday. And the second one's coming up in Olympia, Washington this coming Saturday. And you can find out more information about that at their website, which I'll try to get you towards the end of the program. Anyway, I'm speaking again with Matt Landon. So talk a little more about this, about where exactly this Tesoro Savage project is at. You said there's a permit possibility. You know, I know there's been hearings on it. Exactly what stage is it at right now?
I think that it's still the FSEC process is still ongoing. The Energy Facility Security Infrastructure something commission. Basically, it's sort of a conglomeration of all the permitting agencies in Washington that, you know, allows for you know, just, I guess, everybody to sit at the same table, instead of, you know, you have this one agency that's working in isolation over here, and, you know, and so it's just easier, the process is, I guess, easier for the public to keep up with, and potentially easier for everybody to see, you know, what's going on with the permitting process. And so, yeah, I mean, basically, at this point, we just need to increase the public public pressure and, you know, public visibility of opposition to this proposed terminal, these two proposed terminals in Vancouver.
So exactly where would the Tesoro Savage terminal go if it was to?
Yeah, the facility would be located on the west side of Interstate 5. And it would be, there's a natural gas power plant there in Vancouver. And so it would be very near that and located right beside the Columbia River. So very close to Hayden Island, the natural gas burning power plant. And it would go, you know, very close through. I mean, the trains already do pass through the downtown of Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And there's proposed downtown development that the developer has said, you know, I'm not going to invest my, you know, however many billions of dollars into this project. I'm not going to invest money into this project unless, you know, we're getting, unless these oil trains aren't coming through.
Well, we'll have a lot more time to talk about all this, but right now we do have a caller. Jim is on the line. Go ahead, Jim.
I'm calling you the naysayer, I guess.
Okay.
I'm going the other way. I see it. You guys are backwards on this. You don't want the oil trains, but you don't want natural. Get it? Natural gas? What's the deal?
I'm not sure. Maybe you could expand on your question a little bit.
Well, you're against the terminals, the natural gas terminals. Seems like you'd support that. You'd support pipelines for the natural gas. You know, you'd be 100% for that because it cuts out the, you know, the fossil fuel type part of it. You're using natural gas.
How is that not a fossil fuel?
It's clean. It burns clean. It comes naturally out of the ground.
Well, I mean, does it come naturally? It's being fracked with a lot of massive chemicals injecting into the ground and polluting the groundwater.
How do you get to work?
How do I get to work? I bicycle myself.
You bicycle. Okay, let's say you live 30 miles from your work. How do you get to work?
Well, I mean, these are complex questions. I mean,
yes, I know, but what do you use for light in your home?
Well, you know, admittedly, we are all trapped in a system where we're kind of forced by the way the system operates to use these things.
You're not forced, Guy. You're not forced at all.
Yeah, we are.
You could turn your lights off, not have lights in your home. What do you have for heat in your home?
Well, sir, I mean, these are all good questions and, you know, things that are going to, you know, help the conversation.
You got to use common sense and logic. The best thing for Oregon and Washington would be to have these plants here.
Well, the thing is, I mean, we're looking at a larger impact here. Like, I'm not necessarily an engineer. I can't say, you know, we need to move to diversified energy production and decentralized energy production and get off the grid and stuff. Or, you know, break, you know, the things that I do is I get out in the field and I look at, you know, what are the impacts of these gas wells in the immediate area? What are the impacts of these coal mines? What are the impacts of exploding oil trains? And so from a scientific standpoint, these are all things that are being shown as major impacts and as, you know, completely dangerous. And it's completely unacceptable that our communities are being put at risk and the future of our children's safety and health and stuff is being put at risk for short-term profits. So, you know, I don't have all the answers, and I'm really glad you called in. And hopefully we can keep
that. You're not going to cut me off, are you?
No, go ahead. Continue.
Okay, yeah, because on the flip side, so then you'd support pipelines.
I mean, you know, all of the fossil fuel infrastructure is going to have problems. It's going to, there's going to be dangers. You know, I mean, these are the things that we're looking
at. Bicycle. You know how many bicyclists were killed in the last year?
How many?
Quite a few. I don't know the numbers.
Oh, well, you don't have. I think
how many, you know, you've got dangers in everything you do.
Right. Well, that's why you got to. That's why you got to.
Technology for the pipelines. I mean, you have pipelines in New York City that are 100 years old that are working great. I mean, I think you're totally off base here. I think that you should be supporting all the natural gas infrastructure you could.
Well, no, because actually it's the problem is, well, you know, we haven't even mentioned global warming, which is a, you know.
I don't buy the global warming thing at all.
Well, that's a fundamental difference of point of view that it seems to be a major issue. I mean, it seems like the scientific community is pretty united on, you know, the fact that global warming is actually a reality, and the facts on the ground seem to be bearing that out, considering the loss of the Arctic sea ice. This conversation needs to happen, you know, these kind of conversations do need to happen in more in depth and more in person in the communities, and we probably won't resolve this particular difference of opinion between us on the air right now, but I appreciate your calling in.
Yep, okay, thanks for not cutting me off. Thank you.
All right. And the real issue is that we have to completely reorganize everything we do in our society and in our lives, and we can't let the corporations and private profit rule everything that we do, because that's really what's driving this fossil fuel economy. And presumably, most of our listeners are aware of that. And we have Garth or Barth on the air. Barth, go ahead, you're on.
Excuse me, I'm sorry about the frog. I would like to talk about, talk out to the last caller and make a few points. Natural gas, you know, that may be a misnomer, but basically you have dense hydrocarbon in a gaseous form. And yes, it's natural. It's the result, the same thing that makes crude oil, in the ground, the decay and et cetera of ancient plants and sunlight from quite a long time ago. You know, that's fairly well known. But when you burn natural gas, yes, it burns cleaner than coal. Yes, it has a number of advantages in terms of utility, you know, ease of use, et cetera. Those are strong points. And yes, we heat our houses with those, and some people even run motor vehicles off of natural gas, compressed natural gas. Those are an alternative for specific purposes, but the bringing of this material up out of the ground is tremendously expensive in terms of the energy put in to the energy coming out. And the side effects, besides the cost, the side effects are huge, primarily in the use of water, groundwater, hugely consumptive of water, and the water is not clean. Once you use it for this purpose, they add a lot of secret chemical mixes to it that they will not and are not required to disclose. These are clearly have been found to be toxic compounds. Well, they inject them into the ground to break up the shale, etc., and liberate natural gas. And when the natural gas is liberated, it's collected. The actual yields are relatively small, and those wells tend to go unproductive within just a few years. But you're leaving behind a hugely contaminated groundwater pool. You're contaminating the drinking water for a lot of people, and drinking water is the new gold, for the next century.
Yeah, they're still fracking in California, which is
They're fracking in a lot of places, and they would like to do it in a lot of more places. But the downside is that what you're leaving is essentially wastelands out in these areas, which tend not to be in our backyards, so we don't think of them as sacrifice zones. You know, there's lots of places in Pennsylvania where you can't drink your own water if you had a well on your property, or even the municipal water wells in a lot of small towns are contaminated, and they have to have bottled water because what comes out of the tap is literally flammable and explosive, not to mention hugely toxic in terms of chemical contamination. That's a big part of it. there, you guys are talking about the oil trains and your guest disclosed that there's really quite a lot of volatile compounds, VOCs, the hydrocarbons we're talking about, methane, propane, natural gas compounds that are inextricably mixed into this oil that is coming in by train. Now, that is the volatile that makes them explode. You know, yes, we would like to have natural gas, and yes, we still drive cars, but if you think about the infrastructure that exists in settled areas, populated areas, and the infrastructure that exists to move things from one place to the other, you have a lot of investment and you have a lot of cross connections between the infrastructure and the people that live there and the materials that have to go there for normal life. I'm getting a little rambly, but these trains, these cars, tend to have an explosive character to them. It's something that is a result of getting this heavily, it's not crude oil in the old sense. The oil has quite a lot of these volatiles in it that old crude oil did not have. And so when you're bringing this in, and these cars can each potentially have quite a lot of explosive power to them, and you're bringing them in mile-long columns, four times or so a day, well, you're going to get it. If you have any problem, you know, if somebody's car stalls out on the tracks and a train runs into it, and that happens, you know, if somebody misses a crossing and crashes into the side of the train, and that happens, then one of these cars being ruptured makes it very potentially explosive, and then you have a chain reaction. Well, you got a mile of these cars.
Okay, Barth, we got another caller.
Okay, one other thing. The rail coming into Vancouver comes right along the river most of the way down the gorge. And so and there are neighborhoods on the other side of the tracks in Vancouver, quite a lot of them, and some of them are fairly expensive neighborhoods. Well, those people are virtually going to be cut off for a couple of hours a day because there are going to be trains rolling by that cross all the streets, and there's no other way to get in or out of these places. If there's a problem down there with a medical emergency or any other emergency, there won't be any cross traffic available down into these areas. And if there was a disaster, those people would be trapped on the bad side of things. That explosion could also contaminate the river, and it could also impact directly Portland, especially if it affected any of the bridges, which they all cross under.
Okay.
That's my 2 cents. Thanks. Bye.
Thank you, Barth. And again, this is Wednesday Talk Radio. My name is Paul Rowland. I'm speaking with Matt Landon with the Vancouver Action Network. We're talking about oil trains mainly, the Tesoro Savage, proposed Tesoro Savage plant in Vancouver, another one that's coming down the pike, a New Star terminal. And as I said, we'd hoped to have a railway worker. As I said, mentioned, there's this the Future of Railroads, Safety Workers, Community and Environment. First conference bringing together rail workers and environmentalists happened in Richmond, California on Saturday. So I'm going to have someone give a report back about that. We may still have someone call in. And on this article by John Flanders, who's spent 25 years as a railroad machinist member and past president of IAM 1145, steering committee member of Railroad Workers United, he's retired. And I actually have an email for him as well. He had an article on Counterpunch called Exploding Trains in Crude Oil. And we have Don on the line. Go ahead, Don.
Yes, good morning. Great topic. The last caller stole quite a bit of my thunder. But, you know, I hear a lot of complaining, you know, but I don't hear any solutions, you know. Right now we're stuck using fossil fuels, and until somebody invents anti-gravity or another form of propulsion, we're stuck. You know, I'm not a big fan of driving, but I have to. you know, and oddly enough, I'm a truck driver, you know, so I'm not having any solutions myself. But until we do come up with something else, I think that we need to use what we have, but we need to do it in the safest manner possible, you know. And I understand that, you know, we're a capitalist country, and people want to make money, and they will burn you to the ground just to make a buck, you know. And that really is crappy. That's one of the things I don't like about capitalism. But, you know, right now it is what it is. Does anybody have any other solutions to this problem? And I'll take my answer off the line. And thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to the thing. I mean, I'm not an engineer specifically. I would say probably, you know, energy efficiency is one of the first steps, using electricity and energy that we're using more effectively. And then, you know, figuring out what our next steps are. I don't necessarily feel like I'm complaining, because I'm a scientist. So I'm presenting data. And I mean, I guess some people would see that as complaining, but I don't.
Well, you know, obviously there's many aspects to this question. And I said, my solution is that we need to organize our neighborhood so that we don't use, so there's not so much repetition in use. We have to totally get away from the individualist model that everybody has their own washer and dryer, everybody has their own lawnmower, everybody has their own car. I mean, these are things that are really endemic to the American way of life. We have to totally question the social model in which we operate. And this is a very difficult thing. We prefer to have, you know, high-tech solutions, immediate solutions, but the solutions are in our social relationships itself. There's really ultimately no solution other than to actually collectively organize our lives completely differently. That's a conversation that we need to have. In the meantime, efficiency of cars, efficiency of houses, complete redeployment of resources from the war economy towards weatherizing our houses, towards having more fuel efficient cars, organizing our work lives so that we don't have to go 30 miles away, et cetera, et cetera. This is something that people have been putting out for forever. But the problem is that the corporations who rule our political system and our media system, it's not in their interest to do that. So they'll fight tooth and nail against it. Anyway, I want to let you know that what's coming up today at 9 o'clock on Political Perspectives, Martha Gies interviews the Arresting Power filmmakers who have recently completed the experimental documentary film Arresting Power, Resisting Police Violence in Portland, Oregon. 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia with cutting edge news, views, interviews, and just plain horse sense with Chris Andre. 10:15, we'll hear Flashpoints, investigative news journalism with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, it's the KBOO Food Show, hosted by Chris Siegel. On this episode, they take on a virtual distillery tour around the east side of Portland. And let's have one more caller, and then we really do want to get into this listening project that Matt is involved in. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hello.
Yeah.
Okay. You made the segue for me, political. The consumers of this oil and probably coal are Asian, right? South Korea, Japan, maybe China. Okay, now we step into the other political arena, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Now, if that goes through, you know that the oil trains are going to go through, because that will be a collective corporation owned by people that are not even living in this country. So, you know, if the TPP goes through, I'm sorry, the show's over.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Trans-Pacific Partnership is a key part. These global trade agreements, which is driving this, helping to drive this global economy and reducing all regulations, all restrictions on the flow of capital and fossil fuels and everything else, leading us towards disaster. The global railway train bomb seems to be what's happening. Thank you very much for calling in with that. So, Matt, let's talk about the listening project. I know that's something that you also brought here from the from Mountain Justice, and that was something that people went around in the coal fields doing to, you know, get community input, to establish good relationships with people in the community. So what's happening with that?
Yeah, so listening projects were definitely a very cutting edge tactic that is still being utilized in the coal fields of Southern Appalachia. Basically identifying an area of impact and going door to door and asking local residents their concerns, you know, and if they'd been impacted by the coal mines, what types of actions they'd taken. And at the beginning, we found that people were saying that they weren't impacted by the coal industry, but then as you asked them specific questions, they started to, you know, acknowledge that, you know, family members had black lung and they were having, you know, trouble with their foundation and their houses and being run off the road by coal trucks and stuff. And so we were able to find that the listening project did lead to empowerment of citizens, because, you know, people began telling their story, and then, you know, they started to, you know, move to further actions and stuff. So the end goal of the listening projects is community empowerment. That's one of the end goals. So basically what we're going to do is we're going to enact this listening project here in Portland and Eugene. We're also looking for additional cities as well to be able to start listening projects along rail side communities. So we're on March 28th, we're going to be going from 10 a.m. till 3:30 p.m. to community or neighborhoods along the rail lines in Portland and Milwaukee, you know, just sort of the greater Portland area. We're going to be having two trainings. So you would only need to attend one training, but we're going to have two trainings. There's going to be a training on March 28th at 8:30 a.m. to 9:30 a.m. And then there's also going to be a training on March 27th, which is Friday, and that's going to be from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m. And all these trainings are going to be held at the Portland Rising Tide office, which is at 2249 East Burnside. And so this is, you know, you're going to be able to go out with a partner and go door to door and basically ask people questions about, you know, their impacts from the how the railroad is impacting their lives. We're also going to send you out with maps showing, you know, the current routes of the oil trains through Portland, and as well as information about the propane terminal, the proposed propane terminal. So basically, if you can see the railroad tracks from your house, we would totally really want to talk with you. And we would like to recruit you to be a train watch volunteer. So part of what's happened is that because this is a hazardous material train, that they're the government and the railroads are not really providing information about these trains to the public. Washington State has, I guess, some more liberal laws, and we were actually able to get information that the railroads supplied to the emergency management agency there, saying that, you know, there was X number of trains coming through a week. And Oregon has not released that information to the public. A majority of states have not released that information to the public. And so even with that information, you know, we're still not getting the real-time data, because they're not saying, you know, this is when the oil trains are coming through and this is the frequency. So that is where the train watch is very vital. This is the only real-time monitoring of oil trains that is happening. And so if you see it, tweet it. And so basically what we're doing is, on the Washington side, since April of last year, we've been able to recruit oil train monitors across the state of Washington, and they're using Twitter. And if you're on the Washington side, you're basically going to use the hashtag WA for Washington, Oil Train Watch. And there's additional information if you go to our blog, which is VancouverActionNetwork.blogspot.com. There's additional information on there about how you can start doing the train watch. We're also on Facebook as well. You know what? The person sitting out there tweeting the oil trains is, you know, sort of our low-tech version. And so we're actually... We would actually like to try to get it to an automated train watch. No, such a thing exists as a hazmat placard identification system. This is basically like sort of a facial recognition software that would use a camera and be able to totally automate the system. And but the only thing is the price tag that comes with that software and that setup right now is anywhere from $50,000 to $100,000. So we currently have about $212 in our account. So if you've got any deep pockets and, you know, if you know somebody that's got a property or a house that's right there beside the trains, we would totally love to talk with you and help get this automated train watch going.
So is there a way to reach you specifically?
Yes. If you go to our blog, there's contact information. I can be reached at VancouverActionNetwork@gmail.com, or you can give me a call at 503-765-7176.
Okay, and that's Matt Landon with the Vancouver Action Network. And again, the number to call in, we've got 15 minutes left in the program, is 503-231-8187. And I had mentioned I had hoped to have a rail worker on the program. That's obviously not happening. But you can go to this article called Exploding Trains in Crude Oil, Listen to the Workers, from the March 9th Counterpunch by John Flanders, talking about the first conference bringing together rail workers and environmentalists that happened in Richmond, California on Saturday. And there's another conference on the same theme, the future of railroads, safety, workers, community, and the environment, happening in Olympia this Saturday. And you can find out more about that if you have access to the internet at www.railroadconference.org. I know there's some people from Portland Rising Tide going up there. And Rising Tide is another good group to hook up with on this issue. They've done a number of actions, including blockading the tracks, blockading an oil train a few months ago. So we have James on the line. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning.
So it's really good to hear that that there's so many people who are rallying together against these oil companies that are trying to come in and ruin what we have here in Oregon as far as natural resources. It's good. And it's good to see people not only from Oregon, but from folks from around who know the type of devastation that the fossil fuel industry just wreaks on small communities. Really, I was actually calling in to address a caller earlier that was, I mean, he was just talking about how, you know, it's like, well, this is the best we've got and the best we've got to work with. I mean, I don't know if he changed his radio station, but I mean, really, it's like it might be what we got now, but it's, you know, these fossil fuels is just every day. It's just one more. I mean, yeah, all of us have to drive. All of us have to do this. But it's like it's that kind of disenfranchising attitude that makes it so that we don't have more people rallying together to work on solutions that involve solar energy, to work on solutions that involve wind energy, or more electric cars on the road. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of things that seem kind of space age and far off, but if we have people who continually have attitudes like that towards renewable energy, then of course it's going to be all we got. And I mean, he might be singing a different tune when we get an earthquake caused by fracking down there in California. So,
all right. Well, thank you very much for calling.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, you know, obviously, you know, the transition to renewables is a major thing. The price of solar is going way down. But of course, you know, there's just no substitute for drastically reducing our consumption of everything. There's just the superfluity of what we use, the amount of excess packaging, the amount of superfluous goods, the amount of excess driving that we do, you know, it's really, I'm sorry, but there's just no substitute for it. People don't like to talk about, you know, that sounds like a sacrifice. We have to you know, change our way of life. But I'm sorry, the writing is on the wall. I am somewhat privileged to be able to ride a bike and to be able to lead a life that doesn't require a lot, but we can all do a lot more in our individual lives and in our collective organization. It's just that we're prevented from collectively organizing because the way the society is structured and organized, which is what we're trying to change. So back to this listening project, Matt, that's going to happen again next weekend. So you're going to be having a training on Saturday morning in preparation for going out later on Saturday. And so is this the first time you've initiated this here?
Yes, to my knowledge, this is the first listening project that's happened. The reason that we selected to do a listening project on this side of the river is, I guess, you know, we have historically had more volunteers in Washington on working on this issue and specifically monitoring trains. And so we really wanted to try to jumpstart the monitoring happening here in Oregon as well along the I-5 corridor. So if people are wondering, like, do I live near an oil train blast zone or these railroads, you know, where the oil trains are going, you can go to the Forest Ethics, which is an organization, and they actually have an oil train blast zone map. And so you can kind of zoom in and see, you know, what, like, are the oil trains coming through. I currently have monitored oil trains passing by the Steel Bridge, OMSI, and the Springwater Corridor bike trail down in Milwaukee. So, I mean, we definitely know, and we had at the PILT conference this last weekend that there was a lot of folks from Eugene that were saying that the oil trains were coming through down there. So, you know, we do have this, the whole I-5 corridor is being traveled with oil trains right now. One of the other projects we're going to be doing as well as listening projects is actually doing monitoring of the railroad structures, infrastructures, including bridges and railroad crossings. We were fortunate to be able to receive a drone this past Christmas from Santa, and so we're going to, you know, not be trespassing on railroad property, but, you know, in an effort to try to provide monitoring, some additional monitoring for these older bridges and stuff to, you know, increase the safety of what the railroad infrastructure itself.
Because apparently our transportation departments aren't doing enough of that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, they're all completely stretched thin and underfunded, overworked, and understaffed.
We have Matt Landon talking about the oil trains and various projects that are ongoing and just getting started to monitor the oil trains, and you can be a participant in that. And we left his contact information. We'll get that one more time before we go. I want to mention one more thing. I'd mentioned this propane export terminal. There was another hearing on that yesterday, but there's going to be an extra public hearing about that at the Portland Planning and Sustainability Commission. And that's Tuesday, April 7th at 2:30 p.m. at 1900 Southwest 4th Avenue to weigh in. If you didn't get a chance the last time around, last month, on the proposed propane export terminal. Again, that'll be Tuesday, April 7th. And you can go to the Rising Tide website, among many others, to find out more about that.
So I also wanted to let you know that we were talking about coal mines earlier. Washington State has the only two active coal mines in the entire West Coast. One of those coal mines is 18 miles southeast of Seattle, and it's in Black Diamond, and the other one is Centralia. These are both, oversight. Oversight is done by the Office of Surface Mining. I have over a decade of experience working with this federal agency, and totally want to start working on, you know, figuring out what's going on with these coal mines. So if you're interested in that at all, feel free to contact me. Also wanted to let you know that on April 1st at the Kiggins Theater in Vancouver, Washington, there's going to be an oil train talk at 5:30 in the afternoon. So, and the public is invited to go to that as well.
And there's also an event this Friday, right? With the Rising Tide and the Just Seeds?
Yeah, there's going to be the PNCA art show. This is Just Seeds, an organization is coming. It's going to be at the 511 building, which is by the post office in North Broadway. Basically, Just Seeds is bringing in mostly print artists and stuff, but they're bringing in artists, and they want community members to come at 9 in the morning on Friday, March 20th, to help, you know, get, like, do a presentation, like a 5-minute presentation or something about your organization and about, you know, what you're working on. And hopefully they would be able to pair you with an artist and create some sort of two-dimensional artworks to help support your campaigns.
And we'll get all this information up on the page for this program on our website, kboo.fm. We do have one more caller. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Thanks for the program.
Mm-hmm.
To address some previous callers, I encourage people to get involved. And also, individually, we could examine how we use electricity, sometimes more than we need to, just to pare down more is less for each one of us. And also, the first caller that said, okay, natural gas is natural. I think information is power, so we all need to educate ourselves. And a little bit of sarcasm really does improve gray matter, so we all need to get a little bit smarter. And thank you for the program.
Okay, and thank you for calling. And we are winding down, so we won't be able to take any more callers. I've been speaking with Matt Landon of the Vancouver Action Network. We'll get your contact information one more time. I do want to, again, emphasize this, the future of railroads, safety, workers, community, and environment. A pair of conferences. The first one was in Richmond, California on last Saturday. The second one is in Olympia this coming Saturday. The first conference is bringing together railway workers and environmentalists. This is a very important thing. And again, on the you can read about it on Counterpunch, an article on exploding trains and crude oil. Hopefully I will have someone from the Railroad Workers United. So last words, Matt, and once again, your contact information.
Yeah, so I can be reached at vancouveractionnetwork@gmail.com, or you can give me a call at 503-765-7176. We're also on Facebook and our blog as well. I would say that the time for action is now. The fossil fuel companies are throwing everything they can at us, and the Northwest is getting pounded along with the whole rest of the country. So, I mean, you can't, you know, sit back and watch all this stuff happen and then be like, okay, maybe we should do something about that. But so, yes, please get involved.
Yeah, no, this is an amazing opportunity to look at in a kind of a strange way, to send a dramatic message to the global fossil fuel barons who want to continue to take us down the road to oblivion, that we're not going to stand for it. And we're having some victories, and we could have some other major victories if we're able to really stop this Tesoro Savage project in Vancouver, Washington. And we didn't get a chance to talk about the New Star Terminal, but you can find out more about that. Thank you so much, Matt. Appreciate your coming in.
Thank you.
To Ear to the Streets of Portland on March 19th for an interview with special guest Bay Area recording artist Goapele, who will be performing at this year's KBOO-sponsored event, Sold Out Music Festival, on April 15th. It's a night of special guests and performances on Ear to the Streets of Portland with Goapele and local artists Arietta Ward and friends, March 19th starting at 7 o'clock p.m. right here on your community radio station, KBOO. Tune in online at kboo.fm, on your mobile phone at m.kboo.fm, and follow KBOO on Instagram at KBOO Radio and Twitter at KBOO.
Good morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. Here's what we have coming up for you this morning on KBOO. First, on Political Perspectives, Martha Gies interviews Jody Darby, Julie Perini, and Aaron Yankee, who have recently completed the experimental documentary film Arresting Power.